It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A comprehensive study analyzing how America's lands, water, and wildlife are doing has been pulled by the Trump administration.
Well over 100 scientists and other experts nationwide have been working on the first ever National Nature Assessment, which looks at the state of America's natural resources now and how we expect them to change into the future.
The due date for the first draft was set for 1 week ago, but late last month, contributors on the assessment received notice that President Trump had discontinued the project through an executive order.
Now they're trying to figure out how to release the report and its information anyway.
A contributor from UW-Madison joins us now to talk about the first-of-its-kind report and his chapter on inland water and climate change.
Steve Carpenter is an emeritus professor at the Center for Limnology at UW-Madison, specializing in inland waters, and he's one of the scientists who contributed to that National Nature Assessment. Steve, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Rob. Thank you for having me on the show.
Before we get into your part of this research, big picture, what was the mission of this project?
The goal of the NNA was to summarize the status, the trends, and the future projections of America's lands, waters, plants and animals, and the integrated ecosystem processes, and especially the benefits that they provide to people.
What's the significance of the project? What was the intended use of it?
Well, the goal was to provide a knowledge assessment that connects the dots between nature and people and is framed in such a way that it could be used by local governments, everything from mayors to county executives to state personnel, and also by larger scale organizations like the federal government to make science-based decisions about the natural resources.
And if I understand correctly, Steve, the goal was not to come out and say, here are our recommendations on how to deal with all these issues, right? This was a snapshot of data that decision makers could use. Do I have that right?
That is correct. It was the intention was to write an assessment of the state of knowledge in a way that could be used by decision makers. The phrase that's used in the science community is policy relevant, but not policy prescriptive. So we are not prescribing policy. We're not saying you should do this or you should do that. We're writing sentences like, well, we could do this or we could do that, and here are the logical consequences from each action, and the decision maker takes it from there.
Let's dig into your contribution, Steve, to the project. Inland waters, an important issue in your career and to us here in Wisconsin. What kind of things were you looking at?
Well, we're looking at what it takes to have drinkable, fishable, swimmable water for our inland waters, rivers, streams, lakes, ponds, and so on. And the phrase drinkable, fishable, swimmable occurs in the Bipartisan Clean Water Act that was signed by President Nixon in 1972 and is still important to Americans. Here in Wisconsin, of course, all the listeners know that our state is famous for its 15,000 inland lakes, hundreds of miles of trout streams. We have shoreline on two Great Lakes and the Mississippi River and the Wisconsin River going right through the center of the state. And clean water is important to people in Wisconsin as well. So we were focused on what can be done to provide clean water in the future. One topic we considered was how can inland waters contribute to mitigation of climate change. Already our natural vegetation on the shoreline is very important for flood control. But as an additional benefit, we were looking at the possibility of decreasing release of powerful greenhouse gases like methane and nitrous oxide from inland waters.
Talking to Steve Carpenter, Emeritus Professor at UW-Madison Center for Limnology. One of the scientists who contributed to the National Nature Assessment, it was an ongoing program, canceled in the early days of the Trump administration. And Steve, you'd been working on this. First draft deadline was coming up just a little earlier this month. What was communication like? How did you find out that this project you and colleagues had been working on was done?
I just got an email that said that we don't need the project anymore. I'm a volunteer, so I can't be fired. The federal employees were told to stand down, meaning they were told to do something else. And when the news went out, just one morning, the website was closed, and there was an outpouring of support after the closure of the National Nature Assessment, because thousands of people around the country, local decision makers and practitioners, were looking forward to having the results to use them. And we've heard from publishers who want to publish the book. Since it's almost done, we could produce it within a reasonably short amount of time, and people think they can make money by selling it. We've also heard from private funders who want to fund it themselves and make it available at low cost to local decision makers. We've also heard from more scientists who are interested in contributing, although I think we have an adequate science staff of volunteers. So we're now pivoting from the National Nature Assessment as a federal project to the National Nature Assessment as a non-governmental report funded from private sources and made available as an advisory document. And it will have a new name, and we don't know what the new name is going to be yet. We're in very early in the planning process, and this will take some time, and the plans will be publicized on a new website when we have a clear plan laid out. The first draft is in pretty good shape because it was due February 11th, and all the volunteers had done their work. So we had a pretty decent draft. We have a decent draft already. And so we've got a strong foundation to build on. And it's just a matter of essentially reorganizing our administrative support through private organizations, and then putting the scientists back to work.
I just clicked through to the link to what was going to be the federal landing page for this. I'm looking at page not found. Is there something lost if this report isn't under the auspices of the federal government?
Well, that's a really interesting question, and there's been quite a bit of discussion of that. Of course, an official federal report out of the U.S. We were part of the U.S. Climate Change Global Change Research Program, U.S. GCRP, which is an internationally recognized source of information on global change. So we do lose that sort of authoritative stamp of approval. But on the other hand, this is a blue ribbon group of scientists. A number of the leaders are members of the National Academy of Sciences, which is the highest honor that a scientist in the United States can receive. We have several former presidents of the Ecological Society of America involved. And it's just a top-notch group. And I think we will be respected for our own reputations. One thing that is already coming up is that we can be nimble, flexible, and possibly more impactful on our own without since we will not have to go through some cumbersome internal review processes. So I'm not sure that the impact will be reduced. But obviously the cancellation has slowed us down. It's, you know, we've been working to reorganize ourselves for several weeks now.
And Steve, in just our last minute, obviously a lot up in the air with how this is going to be published and what form. Do you have a hope for when this information will go out to the public, at least a dream timeline in your mind?
Honestly, I don't want to speculate on that. But I would say, you know, something that's got a decent draft now could be produced maybe within a year. But that's pure speculation. And there are 125 different volunteers working on this, and I bet you would get 125 different opinions if you interviewed all of them.
Steve, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. I really appreciate being on the show.
That's Steve Carpenter, Emeritus Professor at the Center for Limnology at UW-Madison. Steve specializes in inland waters. He is one of, as you just heard, over 100 contributors to a study called the National Nature Assessment. It was a federal government effort that the Trump administration halted work on. But as we just heard, stay tuned. It may come out before too long in a different format.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, when a teen experiences an emergency mental health crisis, where do they go for care? A family shares their story.
It's terrifying to know that it's a life or death situation and not know what to do or how to fix it.
A push for psychiatric health facilities for youth, that's ahead on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Wisconsin kids are facing a mental health crisis, and it's showing up in news headlines again and again.
Kids' mental health in Wisconsin continues to decline.
Wisconsin has the fifth highest increase of adolescent self-harm and attempted suicide in the country, with rates nearly doubling since before the pandemic.
There is a lack of providers available for children ages 0 to 18.
Parents whose children have complex mental and behavioral health needs have had to take desperate measures to get their kids treatment.
At the state capitol, a legislative study committee was formed last year. One aspect of their work was to look into how to create psychiatric health facilities for youth and to find out what are the treatment options for children who experience a severe mental health emergency.
As we move further into this conversation, please take note that it involves a family story about suicide.
We're joined now by Dr. Tony Thrasher, a board-certified psychiatrist and president of the Wisconsin Psychiatric Association, and Julie Elfers, a mother in South Central Wisconsin. Her daughter, Brooke, died by suicide last year. Julie is the founder of Brooke's Brigade. It's a grassroots advocacy group dedicated to initiating positive change in mental health laws affecting teens. Welcome to you both.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Julie, I want to start with you. As a mother, let's start with Brooke's story. She was 17 when she passed away. She was an artist, volunteered at an elementary school. What do you want to say about her story and her life?
She was a phenomenal person who was able to help people who were struggling. She was able to identify their struggles. That's why she volunteered in a children's classroom. She was able to see a kid who was struggling and just sit down with them and engage with them and get them working on what they needed to, oftentimes without the other kids even realizing that that particular student had been struggling. She just seemed to identify with them and had a knack for knowing how to help them through it. She has three brothers, two are younger, and she often did the same in our home where one of the kids would be having a meltdown and she was able to just sit with them and get them through it, oftentimes better than I was able to when I was frustrated as a parent.
Hmm. What was her own journey like with mental health?
She grew up a very happy child, always very independent. But as she became a teenager, we noticed she started having more mental health struggles with depression. Then in March of 2024, she was 17 years old. She asked us to take her to see her primary care doctor because she wanted to get on medication for depression. So we took her in, and she was alone with the doctor and told the doctor that she had attempted suicide in the past. So the doctor brought me in to the room with them and said that she suggested we go straight to the emergency department. So Brooke was really wanting to get help at that point. She was interested in feeling better. She had been communicating with us, letting us know how she was feeling. And so when she had asked for medication, I knew she was at the point where she needed serious help. So our doctor let the ER know that we were on our way. And we got there at about 2:30 in the afternoon. And we were not seen until after 10 o'clock that night. She was placed in an overflow room that had glass door separating her and a teenage boy her age. She was forced to put on a gown, and her bed was facing his bed. So she had no privacy. She was sick of being there. She had to walk through this boy's room in a gown to go to the bathroom. And she truly felt like she already wasn't worth it. And then to sit in the ER and not get the attention she needed kind of solidified to her that she wasn't worth it. And nobody was telling her that, obviously, but in her mind, that's what it felt like. So she spoke with the resident. We never saw an attending physician. And she was very emotionally intelligent. She convinced the resident that she was fine. But she also told the resident that she had other attempts at suicide that we didn't know about. The resident diagnosed her with borderline personality disorder, but never told us about the additional attempts. So she had him convinced that she was good enough to go home. So when he brought us back in the room, he said he was fine with having her admitted, but he was also fine with sending her home because she had expressed to him that we had a good relationship with her and that she was comfortable talking to us. So it truly felt like had we not had a good relationship with her, we possibly could have gotten her the help she needed. Sorry.
It's okay, take your time.
So I said that my husband and I said that we wanted her to be admitted because we knew her better than anybody and we knew that she needed help. And he looked at Brooke and Brooke said, "No, I just want to go home." And he told us that since she was over the age of 14, that he could not admit her.
Dr. Thrasher, as a psychiatrist, when you hear Brooke's story, what comes up?
First off, thanks for sharing. We need more stories like this to better understand what needs to improve in a very complicated system. Mm-hmm. So just first off, thank you. To your question, this particular journey that I'm hearing is one I hear from other family members as well, which is when we know something is not right, how do we access it? And I think as a psychiatrist, it's something you're often seeing the difference between how we ask for and receive assistance for mental illness versus other illnesses. And so I always compare it to other things and say, if Brooke was having abdominal pain and you diagnosed appendicitis, you would not wait from, I believe you said 8 hours, two to 10, mm-hmm. right?
Yep.
And that's ongoing. I think there would also be less of the kind of diminishing of the concerns, minimization. So what I hear there is I hear somebody that is struggling, and I think there is an interesting question here that kind of bridges this concept of we want to make sure that the people we're working with as our patients, that we're abiding by and working with them, but at what point in time do you reach a point where you feel the need to intervene for their own good? And I'm not pretending to have a magic answer for that, but I do think when I heard the conversation you had about being over 14 and having that conversation with the people in the emergency room, I think that comes up a lot about voluntary versus involuntary. And the last thing I would say is I think the part that probably, other than the overall end result, that breaks my heart the most is during her time of most need, sitting in a gown in an open window facing by somebody else, which then I think begs the question as a system, are we really treating people with mental crises that it's their worst day and how can I help you? Or is it more about fear, about liability, and how it looks within their own system? And I think that's a question worth exploring.
Dr. Thrasher, can you explain the law in our state where children 14 to 17 have some decision-making power regarding their treatment for mental illness?
I think right now one of the biggest issues which we have been trying to look at through different legislative approaches mm-hmm. is right now the law prefers that if you're over the age of 14, that both parties consent, meaning the adolescent who is a minor but over the age of 14 and the parent both consent to it. And I think that even though there is some wiggle room in the law there, I think there's a difference between what's in the law and what hospitals are willing to admit as well as a different conversation. The majority of psychiatric facilities in Wisconsin are private. They're privately owned. They're a private healthcare system. So even if you may find a legal option for it, if they are not comfortable with it, which I have seen colloquially during my career, that very often if there is a difference in opinion between the older adolescent and the parent or guardian, that a lot of times hospitals are very wary to admit.
Julie, you founded Brooke's Brigade. This is the grassroots advocacy group, to really focus on the positive change in mental health laws affecting teens. Can you talk about what the focus is in regards to these changes you want to see?
So the struggle we had was that as a parent, we were given discharge instructions for Brooke that only gave us a list of providers to follow up with. And so we got on several different waiting lists. But as most people are aware, you can't get in to see a therapist quickly. Additionally, we weren't seeking out the right type of therapy because we weren't told her diagnosis in the emergency department. So for Brooke's Brigade, we're just trying to help other parents navigate this because we didn't know. My husband and I are both educated people, and we just followed the discharge instructions and got on waiting lists and waited, and Brooke died waiting. So it's the worst feeling in the world to be trying to do everything you can to save your child, but not having the resources to do it. And it's terrifying to know that it's a life or death situation and not know what to do or how to fix it. So Brooke's Brigade is just really been trying to get resources out to people and just trying to be a support to people. The amount of people that have reached out to us with stories exactly like Brooke's, just with a happier ending, it's startling. Brooke's situation is not a one-off. This is what's happening every day in our emergency departments. And the hospital we went to is a well-renowned hospital. It's not like it was it was somewhere we were confident taking Brooke. Brooke's Brigade also partners up with the Little Heart Project, which is people make little crochet hearts and then tie tags on that have the 988 number and a positive message. And those hearts are left at different locations just randomly for people to find, just to try to leave a little positive message for people that might need it.
988, the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline.
Yes.
Yeah. We're talking about emergency mental health care in Wisconsin with Julie Elfers, a mother in South Central Wisconsin, founder of Brooke's Brigade. And we have Dr. Tony Thrasher with us, a president of the Wisconsin Psychiatric Association. In terms of the Legislative Study Committee, one of the proposed bills that came out of it, likely to be introduced to the legislature, is about psychiatric residential treatment facilities. What are these types of facilities like?
It's a nice, what I call, in-between option. For a lot of people that are in crisis, the current status quo of being at home with your outpatient provider is not working, and you're in crisis. At the same time, a locked inpatient hospital of usually short duration may not be the best option for you either. The nice thing about the PRTF is it kind of settles somewhere in the middle there. So you have the option of having an inpatient level of care for a longer period of time in a secure facility that isn't necessarily what you would think of as a large medical hospital. And it's a model that ironically is used in our surrounding states. And we know that because that's where currently Wisconsinites are going, is out of state for this same level of care. So I was really proud of Senator James and the Legislative Council for putting this at the top of their list, because it really does allow adolescents and children that are in mental health crisis to have a prolonged treatment option that may not be in the home, but also isn't a locked inpatient hospital unit for 3 to 4 days, which can be life-saving, but very rarely is it prognosis-altering. Mm-hmm. And the PRTFs have a better chance to make that change.
Julie, what do you think of this model?
I honestly believe that if that had been an option for Brooke, she would still be here, because it's what she needed. That's the exact treatment she needed.
I wonder then, Dr. Thrasher, do you find that there could be momentum with this from the psychiatric community, that there would be enough momentum to help convince lawmakers that this might be the next step, because this would require an allocation of funding?
Absolutely. And funding is always a significant part of this. But as far as I can tell from the Legislative Council discussions, the PRTFs have pretty universal support, particularly from the healthcare field. I think as much as I think the frustrations that we're hearing from the family side, there are similar frustrations on the side of providers such as myself that, I don't want somebody hospitalized, but currently being at home is not working. What else do we have in between? Then there are some options. They're called partial hospitalizations or intensive outpatient programs, but they're usually HMO-based, and they are not spread equitably throughout the state. And one nice thing about the PRTF plan and the bill was also to make sure that it's geographically situated to best serve those in need. And I think that's also important, because if you are a family member and your child is in one of these locations, you'd probably like to visit. You'd like to spend time with them. And if it's 5 hours away,
there's no way.
It's not going to work. And that's even more disabling and disheartening to the child receiving the treatment.
Julie, another aspect of Brooks Brigade is to spread awareness, to spread kindness. As you mentioned, crocheting hearts with the 988 messages. Amid the pain of losing a child, what does hope feel like to you?
I told Brooke after she passed that it wasn't going to be in vain, that I would. She was always a helper for people that were struggling. So I told her I would pick up the torch and continue it for her. So it really gives me purpose just to be able to help people, even if I don't know who I help, who she helps. We keep pushing forward, just trying, even if it's just doing something kind for somebody that you never know if they're having a bad day. And it's not going to fix their life, but it might be enough that it gives them hope to get through that day.
Dr. Thrasher, someone might think that the emergency room is not the right place to be in a mental health crisis. And that is also not the that is not the message I'm sure you want to spread either. What would you say about ERs and a mental health crisis?
I think, depending upon where you live, one of the hard things about crises is they don't show up at noon on a Tuesday. They show up after hours, and they'll often show up even when you have, may have a wonderful therapist and you have a wonderful caseworker, but it's 3 a.m. on a Saturday and people aren't around. So you do need to take advantage of the safety net facilities that are statutorily there 24/7, 365, which is why people say, call 911 or go to the emergency room. That being said, the emergency room is not a great place for this. And that's why there have been a lot of investments in Milwaukee. We had a county psychiatric ER for decades. And the idea was to create an emergency room just for mental health crises, so that everybody working there is trained in that. You can set it up the way you want it to be. And I can speak from experience, obviously a biased experience, that it was very fruitful, very fruitful. And I think more places are trying to do that. You'll see other types of non-ER locations, things called MPATH units, E-M-P-A-T-H, or other types of crisis drop-in centers. That works very well for people who are seeking assistance. It wouldn't necessarily help with emergency individuals who are not. But I do think it's really hard to take somebody having a mental health crisis, put them in a medical emergency room. It's just a bad fit. I highly doubt that the emergency room staff are trying to make it worse, but the very nature of it makes it worse. And I think that is well evidenced in the story we just heard.
Yes.
Julie, is there anything else that you'd like to add or anything else you'd like to offer in this moment?
I just would really like to see hospitals offering more resources on discharge. I think that's an easy fix, is to just give these families resources beyond just a simple list of therapists that can't get you in. But I also want people to know that there is hope and there is help.
Julie, thank you for sharing your story. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And Dr. Thrasher, thank you so much for being here.
Much appreciated. Thank you.
Dr. Tony Thrasher is president of the Wisconsin Psychiatric Association. He served on the Legislative Council's Study Committee on Emergency Detention and Civil Commitment of Minors. Julie Elfers is a mother in South Central Wisconsin. Her daughter, Brooke, died by suicide in 2024. She has since founded the advocacy group Brooke's Brigade. If you or a loved one is having thoughts of suicide, call or text 988 to reach the National Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. Again, it's three digits, 988.
Still ahead on Wisconsin Today, a Madison-based author and illustrator share their new picture book about the late civil rights icon John Lewis, where every image, sentence, and word choice is critical.
And it's hard when you've got a person who's led the kind of life that John Lewis did, because there's so much you could put in there.
The book is called Unstoppable John. That's next from WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. The late civil rights leader and congressman from Georgia, John Lewis, was a legend for his lifelong efforts to hold America accountable to its ideals.
He was part of restaurant sit-ins, freedom rides, and even endured a police beating on Bloody Sunday during the 1965 peaceful march from Selma, Alabama to Montgomery.
Lewis later served more than 30 years in Congress. One of his early fights for fairness was a campaign to ensure that everyone could get a library card.
That is the subject of a new children's book called Unstoppable John, How John Lewis Got His Library Card and Helped Change History. The Madison-based creators join us now. Jerry Jordan is a painter who illustrated the book, and Pat Zietlow Miller is the book's author. Welcome to you both.
It's great to be here.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Pat, let's start with you. John Lewis led a rich, productive life as a civil rights leader and a congressman fighting for equality for decades. Why did you decide to tell the story of his fight for library card access?
Well, libraries have always been a huge part of my life, from when I was a kid getting books at the bookmobile through now, where I'm actively involved in my local library. And I had never heard the story of John Lewis's quest for a library card until I saw him giving his acceptance speech after winning the National Book Award for the third novel in his March series. And he told the story of asking for a library card, knowing that the library was going to tell him no because of the Jim Crow laws in the South in 1956. And I thought that was just such a moving story. And then I had read an article in School Library Journal about how throughout his career, Representative Lewis had been sent library cards by libraries around the country who knew his story. And I thought how wonderful that was. So I started doing more research and digging into things. And when I learned that he had actually married a librarian, I knew I had enough material to write a story about him and the role that books and libraries had played in his life.
All of these pieces and threads were coming back for you to this one central idea. And it's also at a time when kids at this age are also getting their library cards.
Exactly. And I think kids today would think, well, of course anybody can get a library card, because that fortunately is the world that they've grown up in. And I think it's important for them to know that it wasn't that long ago where that wasn't the case. And also, secondarily, I think the book just reinforces the importance of libraries. Someone, you know, as accomplished as John Lewis was such a fan of libraries throughout his life. And I think kids hopefully will take that away from the book as well.
Jerry, much of your artwork is portraits of African Americans. What did it mean to you to illustrate this part of John Lewis's life?
Well, it was very special. It's an icon that I've grown up seeing on TV, and you know, I've always admired. And so it was just, I think of it as an honor. So when the opportunity presented itself, I jumped at it.
You jumped at it. Did you start studying his portraits? How did you prepare yourself as an artist for this project?
For this project, and like all my, for all illustration jobs, I had to do some research, look up the name of the library that he tried to get books from. When was it built? Was it around the time when he was a boy? Finding pictures of him as a kid, trying to find a place where, the house he lived in. So get some idea of his surroundings. So I had to do the research, as well as just look at a lot of pictures of him and doing a lot of sketching, try to get a good likeness.
Yes. And as you were looking at these artifacts, what were some words that were coming to you? What were some emotions that you were feeling?
Trailblazer, a real trailblazer, somebody who have opened up a lot of doors. And so my emotions was centered around trying to get it right, to make sure that I did this story that Pat has written to do it justice.
Pat, what did you do to find the words to tell the story about the brutality of racism to young readers?
John Lewis had some wonderful things happen to him, and he had some horrible things happen to him. And I didn't want to downplay the horribleness of what happened. And so what worked for me was thinking about the concept of fairness. I think kids have a very innate, inborn ability to determine when something is fair and when it isn't. And so I leaned into the fact that what happened to him was not fair. It was also racist, and it was a lot of other things, but it wasn't fair. And then I tried to tell the story as simply as possible, like just straightforward, simple words, simple everything, and hopefully in a way where kids would go, wow, you know, that should not have happened.
So Jerry, Pat writes the book and then turns it over to you to illustrate. Now you've got all of these words to work with. You've done your research as well into his life. How do you approach these illustrations and convey images to these words, like relentless?
Well, I read the stories several times. Well, continuously, honestly. I'm always reading it, every page, a couple times over, just to get an idea, get a strong idea, to make sure my drawings that I'm using for that particular page matches the feeling that Pat is trying to get across with her text. And so sometimes it takes multiple drawings and sketches and drawings to get it right. And then when I think I got it right, I'll send it off to the editor and let them take a look at it. And hopefully they agree. And then I'm able to get the green light to get to work and start painting, do the fun part.
Do the fun part. And here's the thing, Jerry. You know, you two are in Madison, so I anticipated that you two were shoulder to shoulder on this, working together. That is not the case.
Exactly. That is not the case. I received an email from my agent, and she told me about this opportunity. And I recognized Pat's name, and because Pat was one of the people, was the person that kind of connected me with my agent in the first place. And so I was like, wow, this is Pat's book. And agent asked me if I wanted to do it, and I said yes, very much so.
Pat, how was this for you? What did you experience in this?
Well, I was really excited that Jerry was going to be the person illustrating my book because I definitely knew of him and I had seen his first book about Ida B. Wells. And like you said, most people think like that we're sitting together like in a room chatting about things, going back and forth, and it's very separate. You know, I wrote the text, he got the Word document, he did all the art. I saw sketches along the way, but I didn't actually meet Jerry until about a month ago. And now I'm seeing him more that we're, you know, doing interviews like this, but it's been great to get to know him, you know, post-book.
We are talking about the new children's book. It's called Unstoppable John, How John Lewis Got His Library Card and Helped Change History. Pat Zietlow Miller is the author. Jerry Jordan is the book's illustrator. Jerry, as Pat said, you've also illustrated the children's book Ida B. Wells Marches for the Vote. What do you appreciate about illustrating children's literature?
Being an illustrator was a dream of mine since I was a little kid. The first time I read a book by the author Robert McCluskey, he was author and illustrator, and his books were, he wrote a book, a series of books called Homer Price. Homer Price in a Donut Machine, something like that. And the book, the drawings were just immaculate, just incredible drawings. And so, and I was maybe about 10 or 11 years, 9, 10, something like that. And I knew then that this was something I wanted to do. And so to have these opportunities present themselves to me, it's just incredible. Just incredible. And so when... I consider my job as an illustrator is to bring together the imagination of the author, myself as the illustrator, and the child. Bring all three of us together as we're looking at that page. And so when the kid sees the book and they're looking at a page, I want them to kind of just get lost in the things going on in the art.
Pat, this is your 21st children's book, and I'm wondering, do you ever have conversations with kids about your books, or have they ever given you some valuable input?
Well, I do school visits where I go in and I talk to kids and I read my books and I do story times at bookstores. And what I love about kids as an audience is they tell you exactly what they think. On the good side, I've gotten kids who have said things like, this is my favorite book when I start reading it, or I have this book at home, which always makes me happy. But one time I was reading to a group of preschoolers and this three-year-old looks at me and goes, this is boring. So you get it like all the way around. And that's cool. I've had kids help me brainstorm ideas for future books too, which is always fun because they just, you know, are very free thinking in how they approach things.
No filter. It's honest. It's going to come right at you. I want to change gears here and toss this one to you, Jerry. President Trump has taken such a hard line against any efforts to promote diversity, equity, and inclusion. What do you make of this hostility towards inclusion as you look at your book projects?
I don't understand it. I know that the argument is, you know, we don't want to make white kids feel bad about themselves. And no one wants that to happen. But I will say nobody was really all that concerned about me when I was a little kid in school. And there was very few, if any, books about African-Americans or any other person of color. It's history. We can't deny history. We should not try to deny the history. Mm.
I wonder, Pat, what are you thinking at this moment as a children's author?
Well, I totally agree with Jerry that it's short-sighted. And I think when you look at books, the beauty of books is they tell your story as a reader, and they tell the story of people around you as a person. And so you can see yourself, you can see other people, you can imagine other ways of being, other ways of living. And that increases your empathy and just your general overall humanity. Because I believe the more we can understand and connect with other people, whether we think they're like us or whether we think they're not, you know, we're just better all around humans because of that. And we all live our own little life. You know, we know our little corner of the world. We don't know
the bigger, broader picture. And that's what books do. When I was growing up in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, I had a very limited understanding of what the world might look like beyond that, but books showed me. And so I just think the more books from the more perspectives, from the more equally valid realities, the better.
You know, the Library of Congress has named its new national ambassador for young people's literature. And I was listening to Mac Barnett and telling NPR that the picture book is an experimental art form and that it is undervalued. And I'm wondering if you view it that way, Jerry. Do you find that we could value these picture books more?
Picture books are a gateway to reading. Just like Pat said, they books open up the world to you. And I think the best way to get a child excited about reading is to start with picture books so that they can look at the pictures and match it up with the text and, you know, just kind of get lost in the story.
Pat, I want to circle back to the late Congressman John Lewis and this book at hand. If you're a parent and you want to have a conversation after reading your book, what might that conversation be like? How might it go as a parent and the child?
All books are great conversation starters, especially when it's based on something that really happened. And I think in this case, you could talk about, you know, were you aware, you know, was the child aware that this used to be the case? How do they think that John Lewis felt? How do they think that, you know, what made him decide to devote his life to changing the rules? What could you do in your life? Is there a rule you don't agree with? Is there something that you think should be different? What could you do as one person to make a difference? Because I think that's the lesson hopefully people can take away, that one person, even if you think you're not the best person, might be enough to, you know, make a change, make a difference. And so I think having discussions around that is really, really good. And then, I think, you know, with all the book bans in the news, you could talk also about what's the importance about reading about a story that happened a long time ago, you know, because now anybody can get a library card. What's the importance of reading this story? And then what's the importance of people having access to the book that might be right for them?
Well, Pat and Jerry, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
That was Pat Zietlow-Miller, a Madison-based children's book author who has published more than 20 books, and children's book illustrator and painter Jerry Jordan, also of Madison. Their new children's book, it's called Unstoppable John, How John Lewis Got His Library Card and Helped Change History.
WPR News will bring you special coverage of Governor Tony Evers' biennial budget message this evening. You can listen to the governor's address and hear analysis from WPR's Sean Johnson and PBS Wisconsin's Zach Schultz beginning at 7 p.m. That's special live coverage here on WPR News and at WPR.org tonight at 7.
It was so special to experience a Finnish sauna in Lafarge and share about it on the show yesterday. And Rob, who knew we could take our microphone equipment into the heat room and it would survive another day?
Nothing melted. Well, hearing about your time in the sauna brought up memories of Finland for Mike in Madison, who writes, "In my 30s, I was selected for a one-month Finnish exchange program where I was a guest with 9 different families. One of the many amazing experiences was being exposed to every conceivable variation of Finnish sauna." Mike says that segment unlocked a flood of happy memories.
Mike, thank you so much for sharing that. And we'd love to hear about your sauna experiences, too, be they Finnish, Swedish, or a Wisconsin Northwoods variety. Email us at wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call or text to get in touch at 888-642-0232.
Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.